I'm Mary Kay McBrayer.
I'm Louise Johnson.
And together, we are Novel Gazing, the podcast that talks literary fiction. We're recording today's show on January 21st, so if anything momentous has happened between now and then, it's not us. That is not our fault. on today's show, we're discussing current affairs and news from the literary fiction world, translated literary fiction, and titles that should be translated, and, of course, sharing our latest reads.
But before all that, let's hear from one of our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate, high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and, oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Greenleaf Book Group. No summer vacation should be without a great read, and I don't know about you, but I am partial to mysteries and thrillers for my hot month reads. It's hot girl reading summer, always over here. And from the award-winning librettist of Legally Blonde, the musical, and the screenwriter of Freaky Friday, Heather Hawke, comes the page-turning psychological thriller, The Trouble with Drowning. So when author Eden Hart floats into Tucson's Antigone Books and all her dazzling perfection to give a reading, Kat, a struggling writer, can't help but compare herself. Thankfully, Kat's life starts to take on its own Eden-like glow when her literary future takes shape and she falls madly in love with Jacob. As demons from her past begin to surface, Kat's mental health craters, and this halcyon dream slips through her fingers. For the fastest-paced, slow burn you won't be able to put down, be sure to check out The Trouble with Drowning by Heather Hawke on Amazon or your retailer of choice. And thanks again to Greenleaf Book Group for sponsoring this episode.
So as Mary Kay said, we are going to open it with news and current affairs. And I think you've got the first one for us, right?
Yes. So in case anyone hadn't heard yet, something that came out this week, which is so delightful, is that the romantics called each other's they called each other names. And in particular, the one that stood out most to me was that William Wordsworth was called by, I think, Lord Byron, William Turdsworth. And I just feel like that's something that everyone needs to know. It's a real thing. It's a true historical fact. But in all seriousness, something that actually did happen this week that I think that we're all going to react to really strongly is the Missouri bill that proposes jailing library workers for recommending books that are subjectively age inappropriate. And Louise, as a librarian, what do you think about that?
Well, I'm quite glad that you led with this because I was too busy screaming slightly incoherently over the whole affair. As you might gather, yeah. I think it's an appalling decision on a multitude of levels. And I really hope that it stays a proposal and it doesn't go further. Firstly, if you work in Missouri in one of the libraries affected or to be affected or part of this discussion, you know, we are thinking of you because it's a horrible place emotionally and mentally to be in.
Really?
Yeah, it's just ridiculous.
It is, right? It's ridiculous, right?
Yeah. How do you even police this, or how do you make this work.
Exactly. It's so subjective. Number one. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. I just fired up about this. Continue. I'll wait my turn.
No. It's fine. Go. I'm quite prepared to like just breathe and calm down briefly.
Okay. So number one, no one is going to, in good conscience, recommend a book that is not age appropriate.
Exactly.
No one's going to do that. Least of all, a library.
It's not
worker.
A thing.
It's not a thing. It's really just, it seems like a thinly veiled sort of prejudice against, I don't know, like different or like non-heterosexual orientations. And
well, in a sense,
I don't
it's
like
a prejudice
that.
Against literature, isn't it, in a way? This kind of
yeah.
thing that can give you so many routes out of the world that you find yourself in. And the only route that is deemed appropriate for you is the one that we shall let you see. And I think that's just so abhorrent on 1,000 different levels in 1,000 different ways, in that you can say, all right, I, this person in this decision-making place, I can decide for all of you what is right and what is wrong that you should have access to. How can that ever be? A good place to end up at?
Yeah. Also, the person who would make those calls is not a person that I want making that call.
Exactly.
If that makes sense. I'm so full
it's
of
like,
bile.
It's like asking the dentist what you want to have for your shoes, you know? There's no connection there. So, yeah, sorry, the first couple of minutes of today's show are basically going to be us just kind of screaming and going, oh.
Yeah, I'm just worked up into a stuttering rage. Why?
It is. And I think as well, the big thing that really concerned me was that, you know, the whole concept of self-issue machines, you cannot have somebody stood there 24 hours a day or however many days, hours you're open. You can't have someone stood there going, actually, can I just check your book before you take it out?
Right.
It's so.
And who decides what's age appropriate?
Yeah, it's such a decision to make for someone.
Yeah. I mean, like, who decides what ages are appropriate for certain things is what I tried to say. Not who, but the decision of that in general. Like, I don't know. I just.
But this is one of the things that we should be leaning away as a society.
Agreed.
Away from that kind of someone makes the call for us, but rather. Shouldn't there be bills and people working towards a system that allows you to make that call yourself, you know?
Yeah. And should books be banned? Also, like any books? I don't know. I know we're going to talk about that a little bit later, but that was one question I had.
Yeah, so I think it's worthwhile shouting out about it. And if you are in the area and you can make a difference, please consider these points, and you know you'll know the situation better than either of us if you are there. But please, you know, talk to us about it, and we'll happily go on your behalf on this.
And it's only library workers; it's not booksellers.
Yeah, how is that like a legitimate call to make? That actually,
it's not legitimate because in a bookseller you're making money, so it's fine. If you're making money off of it, it's fine.
And I'm back to the incoherent kind of spitty with rage at the mic here.
Same. Okay, should we move on?
Yes. So essentially, it sucks, it's lame, and if you are impacted by it, you know, we have your backs.
We do. Article number two, led by Louise.
I wanted to talk about the Booker, which is the big sort of Lit Fic prize in the UK. It is essentially the kind of Oscars for literary fiction, if you've not come across it before. And it's a really interesting way of getting a like a snapshot of what's going on and the titles that you should read and the titles that you should maybe think about, you know, getting on your radar at some point. As someone who does a lot of reading through the local library, there's always a massive queue on these titles. So I love that because it shows how popular they are. But equally, cool. Yeah. So there's like, I'm looking forward to Bernadine Evaristo's Girl, Woman, Other, which was one of the joint winners this year with Margaret Atwood's The Testaments. And I have sort of mixed feelings about Margaret Atwood's win this year. I think it should have been a Bernadine Evaristo sort of fully on her own basis there. But the mm-hmm. article that I wanted to mention for our discussion today was about Lee Child. And he is the thriller writer, the Jet Reacher novels. He's joining the judging panel. And I think that's a really interesting call, getting someone from very commercial, driven, successful, popular, to use that in sort of inverted speech marks, onto this panel. And I was sort of thinking, well, how is that going to impact the titles that are picked in the future? And do you think it is?
Probably. Because, I mean, and I don't know a ton about the Booker Prize, but I thought it was for literary fiction.
It is, yeah. So they're picking, like, the best of the literary fic.
Yes. So to me, this sounds a lot like setting it up for when Bob Dylan won the Pulitzer or for literature.
Okay.
Well, that's not really the same then. Like, it's just, again, not bad or wrong, but different. And
yeah,
seems like a weird call.
No, I don't know. I think I like to see it in action, because you can't quite ever ascribe change to one person. But I would think,
sure,
in this context, I would hope that maybe he would introduce that note of difference that you mentioned. And I think that could be quite an exciting thing, because any award scheme, any and this ties into our first thing, right, about the people who have the right to choose mm-hmm. what you read and how you read it. Anything gets set in its ways. It makes certain decisions on your behalf. And I think that an attempt to shake that up, an attempt to kind of go, actually, we're going to listen to these perspectives from other voices and other places, is a pretty cool mm-hmm. thing.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think it's going to be one to see in practice, as it were.
Sure, I can buy that. And I guess I am a little bit more of a traditionalist than I like to admit.
Uh-huh.
So, well, we'll see, right?
So for you, is it more like it wants to be what it says on the tin, then, so to speak?
I think so, but I am also, I don't know, I think I'm just kind of wary of change until it happens and proves itself to be good.
Yeah, I think that is a valid point, actually. You do want to hope that these things are done with a great positive intention, because I know the book had got right. a lot of grief over splitting the award last time to, as I say, Margaret Atwood and Bernadine Evaristo. So you kind of wonder, okay, is this some reaction to that? Had they planned it? Where'd it come from?
That, and also, how do you so you don't like that two people, like, joint won the award?
No, right? I found that a bit difficult, because I don't think that The Testaments is Margaret Atwood's best book at all. Okay. And I think in a way they kind of saluted her status and her achievement rather than the book itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, awards are weird like that, because number one, we made them up. They are subjective, no matter how
no matter how objective you try and be.
Right, we try to be. So maybe they brought in Lee Child as a sort of tiebreaker judge. Like, I don't really know him. So, right. I mean, not like as like to add to the ranks necessarily, but if he is a very decisive person, that might be, like, if they split the award 2 years in a row, whoever is in charge of the award is probably like, okay, what? It's an award for one person. Like, you can't do that. And I don't know what all comes with it, but if I was a winner, I would be like, so does that mean that I, like whatever the reward is split in half, so I'm actually earning less than the person who got the runner-up position? How does that work?
I think it did mean that it was split, so it's a difficult call to, I imagine, just emotionally handle at that final moment.
Right, I feel like I would be I don't know if you know this, but when King Solomon had to decide who was the baby's mother in the Bible, and he was like, "We'll just cut the baby in half, and each of you can have half of the baby." and the one mom is like, "Yeah, I'm cool with that. That's fine." And the other one is like, "Absolutely not. She can have the baby." Like, I feel like I would rather win second place than tie for first.
I don't know, but I'm suddenly loving this metaphor and the way it suddenly came out. Awards are like babies. It's just how it is.
Right. I want it all, or she can have it.
Yeah. That's how it is. And just this poor confused baby somewhere in the middle just going, "I just don't know what's going on."
Right. Family takes all forms, you guys. Like, I can go back and forth. Oh, man.
So, yeah. Okay. So, I think that kind of ties in as well. I don't know if you saw that Lee Child was quitting writing the Reacher books. And his brother is taking over the series.
What?
I know, it's so interesting.
What a world. We're living in a crazy world.
It's so weird, but kind of brilliant. But I don't know, it fascinates me, this whole, like, you can write my hero that I came up with thing.
Yeah, it's like a passing on a legacy.
Yeah, I think a legacy is actually quite a cool way to think of it. It's like his cultural legacy.
I mean, people do it with movie series all the time. So, but then you have like a really polarized fan base where they're like, no, I don't like that interpretation.
So, yeah, it'd be fun to see like where the first non-lead child, lead child comes out.
Right.
I was like, the sentence there got a bit complicated, but I hope everyone followed it.
I mean, I was following it.
Awesome.
I'm into it.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have 7 great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number 6. So if he is to have 7 great loves, does that mean his time with Irena is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode.
Should we move on into our discussion about translated literary fiction?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay.
All right. So, yeah, translated literary fiction is the big sort of thrust of today's topic that we wanted to pick up on. And hopefully it's going to provide less, than what we've discussed before. because it's a bit more straightforward, right? A book that is translated from one language and presented into another language is something that you do think is a simple prospect, but I think that it's superficial, that reading, in a way that is something that we can unpick now. Translated literary fiction is difficult to find. The example that I can think of here is La Bastarda by Trifonia Melibeo Obono, who is an Equatorial Guinean woman, and it's the first novel by an Equatorial Guinean woman to be translated into English. It is officially, I just think it's brilliant, even from that sentence, that you get so much about its story. Right. It is officially banned in the country, though. I did see online that it is apparently available. I, based in the UK, I had to order it from, I think, a seller in New York to get a look at it. And as I say, I was intrigued from even just the concept of it being the first novel from that context to be translated into English. And it's kind of remarkable, but it's not the sort of book that I can easily find on the high street shelf here. So I was wondering, you know, Mary Kay, what your thoughts would be. Like, how do you find literary fiction? Does it pop up in the world for you easily?
I think generally it comes to me. I don't know what, like, I don't know how, but I think it has so far. But I have a book, so I have a question too about why that book was banned. Do you know?
I think it's due to the sexuality, the content. It touches on LGBT themes in quite graphic detail. It's a girl coming of age and realizing that she's attracted to same-sex relationships, and it is quite eloquently and elegantly done. It's a really unusual book, and it's very literary in tone, even though I came across it through some research for young adult literature that I was looking for. And I think, in a way, that almost misrepresents it, in that, you know, you think it is a teenage young adult novel, and I love those to pieces. But this is a book that you shouldn't read with sort of specific labels, because it's so big. It's almost like a fable, sort of fairy tale effort, and it's translated by a guy called Lawrence Schimmel, who I follow online, and is a really interesting translator because he works with some sort of unusual texts. And yeah, I think it appealed the start, and then hearing its story, I was like, this is actually a really unique, unusual book trying to do something unique and unusual. And this is the sort of text that should be very much easier available than it feels like it is.
Sorry, just again to clarify, is it banned in Equatorial Guinea, or is it banned in England?
Yeah, as far as I understand. So it's banned in Equatorial Guinea, but it's widely available.
And it just hasn't released yet in England?
No.
Or hasn't?
Not that I can see. It's Feminist
Press.
Is it in New York? It's a New York-based publisher, from what I remember. And it's just not an easily available text here. I've mentioned it to a ton of people, and, you know, you get blank looks, which is fine, because it is...
Yeah, I had never heard of it.
Yeah, so. But I think it's so interesting in that these... And I think maybe what I'm reaching towards in this kind of convoluted manner is the fact that maybe these should be the stories that big, big, big commercial publishers should be looking for.
Yeah, for sure. That's what happened with Frida and her paintings, too, is that she got super famous in Chicago and New York. Hmm. And one of her, like, I think she was on her, maybe not her deathbed, but on her sickbed. But she made them move her bed so she could go to her first show in Mexico. So maybe what happens is that Obono gets famous in New York, and then people in Equatorial Guinea are like, well, they like it, so maybe we should look at it or read it. So, which is a really backwards way of doing things, but I do think that, like, any way you can inspire change that looks like tolerance is a method worth trying. So, but that is cool, and I'm looking forward to seeing that. Also, does La Bastarda mean the girl bastard?
I think so.
Is it from Spanish or French? I don't know. I'm ignorant of this.
I would say,
what was it translated
Spanish
from?
Although my knowledge is, like, so patchy at this point. I this was something I was thinking of as well when we were discussing about the idea of translated literary fiction. The majority that I come across in the library and the shops is French, maybe from Spanish background, Spanish-speaking Latinas.
Okay.
But from different
Yeah, I was
contexts,
thinking about
rare.
that too. Most of the, now that I'm thinking about it, most of the translated work that I come across is translated from Spanish. Mm. Not necessarily from Mexico, but I also am wondering if that's like a regional thing, because I'm in Atlanta. So
okay,
that could be the case.
Well, yeah,
occasionally someone who's already famous that's translated from like Norwegian or something like that.
Yeah, there is a whole section of like the Norwegian dark crime Nordic thing, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I'm also wondering too if part of the reason is because they like Spanish is easily translated into English, whereas something that there are many people who know both Spanish and English, so I imagine that it's somewhat easier to find a solid translator.
That can work in that. Yeah, those people that know the language.
Right, because I remember reading a translation of Anna Karenina and being like, what is going on here? I do not understand, just on the level of syntax, what is happening. So, I don't know. And then I've also heard, like, from Chinua Achebe and, oh my gosh, Chimamanda. I always get her last names switched.
Ngozi Adichie.
Adichie? Okay. Yeah, I always get those switched. I don't know why. But they have said that it's very difficult to translate from Igbo into English, because Igbo is not really like a narrative language. So both of those books were originally written in English.
Okay.
Because right. So it definitely has like a lyrical quality that's different. And I don't know what to make of that. It's just like some observations that I made. So I'm sure that there are many more people who are much more informed about that topic than I am. But that's just like after teaching world literature and stuff like that. One of the parameters I put on myself was like it has to have been translated from another language.
Hmm.
But I did make the exception for those last two authors. But yeah, it's very interesting to me the way that like some of the syntax still comes over into English, even though it's not in its original language.
I think that's really cool when people can capture that rhythm and like the quality of a story that is, you know, from very different sort of contexts.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best academic papers I remember reading was about the Jolly Postman, which is this brilliant children's book series. Forgive me for the slight digression away from literary fiction, but it is relevant, I promise. It talks about how they translated the Jolly Postman, who is a guy who delivers letters to various fairy tale characters, into different languages, and it discussed how the translator found, you know, like an equivalent for these very British points of references in, I think it was Dutch, maybe? You know, and it's cool. Such an interesting thing, because you're having to read, when you read a book like this, you read kind of what you think the original is, but then you also read the translator's version of it. So there's all these layering of these different texts going on, and you're kind of having to navigate your way through.
Yeah, that is interesting, and I imagine, like, I think it takes a really special person to be able to translate things. Like, you have to be not only very well-versed in at least two languages, but understand that some words just, they don't transfer. Like, we don't have a word for that in English or whatever, which is, we always make the joke, right? Like, English isn't one language. That's why it's so hard to learn. It's actually three languages sitting on each other's shoulders wearing a trench coat. So, I read this article, and I'm going to link to it, of course, in the show notes, about why we like untranslatable words. Like, when you think about it, we've adopted so many, like ennui, karma, schadenfreude. That's one of my personal favorites. Zeitgeist. And I know for me personally and several of my friends, all or like this is not specific to several of my friends, but friends who grew up in language in homes that speak more than one language, all of my baby words were Arabic words, and like a lot of the swear words that I knew, because I wasn't supposed to say bad words, but if I did them in Arabic, no one else knew what I was saying, so it was fine. And of course, I was living in like rural Georgia, so if you're in like a place that speaks Arabic, they would know what you're saying, and it would be horrible to hear that come out of a child's mouth. But I know that some of those words too are hard to translate. Like even when I asked other Lebanese people in Lebanon, like what does haram mean? They were like, oh, it means forbidden. And I was like, well, that's not the way that my family used it. They used it to mean like, oh, that's pathetic. How embarrassing for you. Like that's how, and so they were like, oh yeah, it also means like pitiful, but that's like a really weird way of using that word. And so like, it's just, it's interesting when, I feel like it's like an inside joke, right? Like if you say it and someone else understands, it's like, oh, I got you. Like, and that's kind of a cool thing that translators get to, I imagine, deal with. Like, for example, another example, when I was in my undergrad, and I don't know how they pulled this off, but it was like multiple departments funded Youssef Komunyakaa to come read to us. And it was amazing. And I got the book, and my stepmother is Filipina, but she also lived in Asia for a little while. And the title of it was Dinky Dow. And I didn't know what that meant. And she was like, oh, that's the word that the Vietnamese soldiers used to describe the Americans as crazy. Like that was their kind of crazy. Like that was a really like a very culturally specific term that other veterans of the Vietnam War would know, but not really anyone. I think her father fought. I can't get all of it right because this is like I'm just kind of like information dumping right now, but this is a topic that's really interesting to me because language is so fluid, and just like any other art form, it's like there is no true like ultimate like stand. I mean, we standardize it, but that doesn't mean it's like true. Like if you look at old texts that were written in English, like really old ones, I can't read that. Like in a couple generations, no one's going to be able to read cursive. So,
yes.
Yeah. So it's just, it's interesting how it adapts.
Yeah. And you kind of have these moments, don't you? Of like the word is translated, as you say, with your usage of words that mean certain things in your family, but for others, it's totally different. You translate like that moment.
Right. And some of that is connotation, but right. And then I just wanted to mention also one of my most recent favorite translations of Aladdin by Yasmin Seal. And we'll link to that in the show notes too, because I loved that story as a kid. I know that it's not considered literary, but I think that's largely because it's an oral history.
Oh, nice.
But I still wanted to tell everybody about it because I want to be her friend so bad. She's so cool.
See, my problem with Aladdin is now I'm like, now you mentioned it, I'm working my way through the Disney soundtrack in my head. So I'm trying to like step away from the power ballads and go, all right, okay. Yeah, good book.
Right. And I didn't realize, like, it's so interesting the way they fuse that music in that movie, because it's like New Orleans jazz and Arabic music together, or Arabian music together. See, which is just real interesting.
We need to do like a musical lipstick special at some point in the future. We need to make this work.
Right. So how do you find translated works?
Do you know what? Obviously, a lot of it is literally just through look. There's, you know, a vast amount of bookshops will have translated fiction. But as I've mentioned like earlier, it is from such specific cultural contexts. And I think, in a way, it's the ones that perhaps commercially are viable, that are successful. But you kind of ache every now and then for someone to take a risk and give me something from somewhere that I've never heard of. You know, for example, Equatorial Guinea. She says, subtly dropping a reference back into that great book. Right. But yeah, you kind of get you kind of get the preconceived notion of what you should be reading in translated fiction. And that's not to say that it's wrong, and it's not to say that it's inappropriate for you to read these books, because gosh, if I ever say anything is inappropriate to read, you can throw me onto the naughty step straight away. But it is just that you should have more options here, I think. And related to that, you know, I was reading a reference book the other day, and there are some amazing books that don't even go anywhere near the English market. And one of them that I am slightly obsessed with is a Norwegian kind of picture book graphic novel hybrid about a child and her mother, and her mother's dealing with depression. And it's called, and I'm going to pronounce this as correctly as YouTube has taught me, so my apologies in advance, Horret til Mamma. And it's such an interesting looking book that is so unique. And yet, because I am English speaking and my Nordic languages are non-existent, I can't get anywhere near this literature. And I sort of think, you know, every now and then, maybe we should have more wild cards thrown out there. So, yeah, related to that, I think if you are a bookstore who specialises in these, or actively searches out the weird and the wonderful and the diverse, beautiful, brilliant oddities in the world, let us know and we'll happily give you a shout out.
Oh yeah, we would love to do that.
Yeah, I think that'd be great, because we want to get these books into people's hands. And if you're part of that process and you're doing it with great, you know, unusual things, yeah, talk to us.
Yeah.
All right, shall we go on to our current reads?
Sure.
All right, so, yeah, you were mentioning to me about a book called Magnetized, weren't you?
Yes, so this book is already released in Spanish. The English release comes out in June, but I'm reading an advanced copy. The book is called Magnetized, Conversations with the Serial Killer. And the author is Carlos Busquet, but it's translated by Samuel Roeder. And so this is a book about an Argentinian murderer. And although it is nonfiction, like you can tell it's nonfictional, the way that he has structured this and abridged some of the conversations and included just bizarre excerpts of the interviews that he conducted with this murderer, whose last name is Malogno, I think. Let me make sure. I probably mispronounced it, but Malogno is how it looks phonetically to me. It's very interesting because you can tell that he's the murderer was dissociated at the time, and he's been in prison and served his sentence. But every psychiatrist that comes across him is like, no, he's not safe. Okay. Do not let him out of jail. So there's kind of like a legislative battle, because he technically he served his sentence, so he should be released. But even in these interviews, he's like, oh yeah, I have a dark presence and I'm a Satanist and I was raised in Santeria.
But, wow, that's a way to get yourself released, yeah, isn't it?
Right. That's very like, he's like, that doesn't make me like a bad person. And I don't even remember killing those people. And it was just like seemingly random taxi drivers that he murdered. And I'm not spoiling anything because I haven't finished the book yet, but all of this is like in the beginning. And it is, if you like horror, it is one that you should not miss, because I mean, even the epigraph talk, it's like, I'm going to read it to you actually, because I can't not, because it's so short. And I was just immediately like, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to read this at nighttime. It's Ampere Circuito Law. A current that circulates via a conductor generates a magnetic field around the conductor. The intensity of the magnetic field is proportional to the current circulating.
Okay.
like, I don't know what to do with that. But it's very good. And that's, again, Magnetized, Conversations with a Serial Killer by Carlos Busquet. So, yeah. Oh, what are you reading right now?
I went on a hunt for some... to see kind of what was in the shops and what I could get. And I ended up picking up a book that the lady in the charity shop looked very sympathetic as she handed it over. She went, oh, that is too big for me. That's too long. And I was like, look, love, I'm not reading this in a day. Trust me. So I am reading Les Misérables by Victor Hugo, and it is the 2013 Woo! Translation by Christine Donohue, and it is big. It is epic. But cool. I think it's one of those books that you can take slowly, because if you're familiar with the story, and I suspect a vast amount of us already have some idea of what Les Mis is all about.
I think I asked you.
You have a handle on what happens, so you can do it slowly and you can do it steadily. I remain team Eponine in a thousand different ways, although I wish she'd get a grip earlier and go off and do her own thing quite happily. But yeah, it's a good solid book, but it does kind of prove the point that I think I was trying to stumble towards earlier, is that especially in the context that I, in the literary context that I exist in, is that you are presented with these kind of standard classics of translated fiction, and I'm desperate for the weird strangeness, as it were.
Well, I would like to take this time to thank our sponsors and thank you for listening. And don't forget to subscribe through however you get your podcasts. And don't forget to tell all your friends about us.
Yeah.
And we'd also really appreciate it if you could leave us a review and rating if you enjoyed this episode, because it helps other people find us.
Yes, please.
And
do.
You can find us individually. Yeah. Louise, you want to?
Yeah. So my website is didyoeverstoptothink.com. And I'm on Twitter at ChaletFan.
Yeah, and this is Mary Kay. My author website is marykaymcbrayer.com, but I'm also on Twitter at mkmcbrayer and Instagram at marykaymcbrayer. I really just didn't overthink it. I was like, let's just use my name. It's fine.
This is good logic. I like this.
And if you like if you like horror movies, you should give my comedy horror podcast a listen as well. It's called Everything Trying to Kill You, and that'll just be like a supplement to our literary fiction, basically. But thank you so much for listening, everyone. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Bye.
Bye.